So welcome to A Life in Biography. I'm speaking with Paul Alexander and about his new biography of Billie Holiday. Paul, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in Billie Holiday and decided to do a biography of her?
Well, as you know, Carl, since we've known each other forever, you know, I've sort of had a career of writing biographies, but I sort of can't remember life without Billie in the background. You know, I was born and raised in and around Birmingham, Alabama, and would go to New Orleans on occasion when I was young. So sort of jazz was a part of the mix. And, you know, she's just always an artist that I keep going back to because I love her music so much. And so eventually I started looking at the work that had been published on her. And I just felt there was room for a book that sort of came from her point of view that was very sympathetic or empathetic, I would say, to the life she lived and the obstacles that she had to overcome. And so the pandemic hit and I was looking for something to do. And my agent said, how about a book on Billie Holiday? And so that's how it all got started. I wrote this book during, you know, interviewed people and wrote the book during COVID shutdown.
Were you able to interview people in person or did it have to be by phone?
That was the weird thing. So you'll know about this because you've done this so often. I had to, because we were in lockdown, I had to do everything over the phone or internet. So I had to do all the university research by email. You know, they were sending me thousands of pages of stuff through email.
Yeah.
And I had to do I had to interview everyone over the phone. And so now finally the book is out and, you know, we're doing events for it. And I'm finally getting to meet all these people that I'd interviewed sometimes over and over and over again on the phone.
Yeah.
It's a real trip, actually.
Yeah. How would you compare the doing it in person and doing it on the phone? I've done both and I'm sure you've done both, but having to do it exclusively on the phone.
I've never done a book where it's exclusively on the phone. It's always a mix, you know, because some people can't, you know, you can't get things worked out to meet in person or they're in another country or something. So I've never done a whole book with just interviewing people over the phone. And I would say that I got an enormous amount of information that way. But I don't know about you, but I still prefer seeing them in person. You know,
I like seeing them in person. Doing it on the phone is kind of like listening to radio in a way.
It is.
There are certain advantages.
Right.
People can imagine, you know, even if they've seen a picture of you, they can sort of imagine what you're like. They're not responding to you physically. They're responding to your voice. And to some extent, that has some advantages.
It does. It really does focus the dialogue, you know, because there are literally no distractions. You know, there's not people walking through the room or phones ringing or whatever. So it's just you and the person.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of intimacy that happens over the phone, too.
I think so. Yeah, there's a real intimacy. That's one of the things that I just finished a biography of Ronald Colman. He did a lot of radio work. And there are things that he does with his voice. Of course, he can do it on screen too.
Right.
But when you have only the voice, kind of power to it.
And in that intimacy, I think there are occasions where they tell you stuff that they really didn't mean to tell you.
That's
the
what
guard
we hope
goes
for.
Down a little bit, and oh, I'm just talking to Paul on the phone here. You know.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
They
that's
end
right.
up saying stuff that they later wish maybe they hadn't, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm intrigued by your book. By the way, I think it's just wonderful.
Thank you for your review in the New York Sun.
I was about to mention my review. I didn't want to gush and make readers think, well, he's just, you know, praising somebody out of the desire to praise. But what really struck me about your book, and I'd like you to talk a bit about it, is and it's in the title, you're writing about her last year.
Yeah.
But in the process of writing about her last year, of course, we learn a lot more about her than just about her last year.
Right.
Was that something that you started out with as a plan?
Yes.
Or something that you hit upon?
Yes, you'll understand this. That was in the proposal that got sent out to book publishers, because I wanted to know, Carl, this is the first time in my whole career, I think, that the editor didn't change the title or the subtitle of my book. You realize how, you understand what that means.
Yeah.
So it was in the title, in the proposal, the title and the subtitle. So they knew exactly what they were buying. And I wanted to do that because, you know, I had just seen that Judy Garland movie that Renee Zellweger did a few years back. That she won the Academy Award for. And what I liked about that movie so much is that by focusing on that one little episode in her life, you know, just before and just after, but mostly that one gig in London, you got to do a really deep dive and you really got to be with the character up close. And that's what I wanted to do with Billie. I wanted you to be able to go in the rooms with her, to be in her dressing room, to be in her little apartment on the Upper West Side, and to be in the courtrooms. And in order to do that, you can't, I didn't want to write one of those, you know, spanning biographies that goes over the whole, because I did that with Sylvia Plath.
Yes.
I didn't want to do that again with Billie. And so by doing it, you get really up close to her, like what she's wearing, what kind of makeup she has on, you know, the whole thing. But then to understand that particular episode, sometimes you would have to do flashbacks.
That's right. Yeah.
And set it up. So it was very cinematic in a way.
What's great about that, and it's what sometimes torpedoes even very good biographies and certain biopics, is the soup to nuts, the chronology can sometimes defeat a biographer.
Right.
Because you have to go from beginning to end. And if the end isn't good,
right,
it's a real downer.
Right.
But in a way, by starting as you did, that's just sort of a given. Of course, she's going to die. And of course,
we all know, because that it's in the title. She's going to die by the end of this book.
So. Well, you're going to laugh at this. But when I proposed my biography of Sylvia Plath, the first one that was published in 2013, I wanted to use the word death in the title. And my editor at St. Martin's Press says, oh, you can't. It's such a downer. And I'm thinking, they don't know that she's going to
like
die.
There's a reader in the world who doesn't know how the story ends.
Who's going to say, oh, I can't read that.
Oh, you mean Sylvia dies?
Yeah. Editors and publishers are so strange.
Isn't that hilarious?
One of the other things that I wanted to mention in connection with Plath, too,
that is the funniest thing. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah. I know. So they changed it to the life and arch rather than the life and death. It was just bizarre. But the thing was that once the proposal was accepted, actually, it was before it was accepted. My agent said, well, you have to do a sample chapter. I was hoping I could get out of that. But she said, no, you got to do a sample chapter. And I said, well, what should I do? And she said, oh, just do, yeah, they just want to see something. You know, they want to see a sample of your writing, a chapter from the book.
Yeah, like they can't buy any of your books.
Yeah, exactly. So she said, well, just go start at the beginning. And I thought about it, and I thought, no, if I'm going to sell this book, of course everybody wants to know about how she died and why she died and so on. So I actually wrote the last chapter of the book first.
Oh, that's interesting. So you know where you were headed from the start.
Well, it just gave me such tremendous momentum.
Yeah.
I had never done a book like that.
Well, I think I had a version of that with this, because I knew.
Yes, that's why I'm bringing it up.
I knew the death scene. I mean, we all know the death scene. She's in the hospital. They arrest her. She's, you know. And so I knew how it was going to end. So all the planning of, you know, that, because it covers about 12 to 14 months of the end of her life, was all, you know, it was all directed towards that final scene in the hospital.
Yes.
So all the characters, you know, that come into the story, I set them up because we know they're going to be there at the end of the deathbed. And it really became an organizing principle of the whole book.
Yeah. And it just works beautifully.
It does. And so far, the people who've read it seem to be very affecting. You know, like it's very emotional when she finally dies.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is interesting because we all know she's going to die.
Yes, we know she's going to die. And yet, my God, you think, you know, well, that's it. She can't do another performance. Right. And then she does another performance. Yeah, that's just a tremendous way to do it.
Catherine Russell read the book to give me a blurb for it. The great jazz singer, who also a wonderful gospel singer too. And she said what she took away from the book was the drive to sing. Billy's drive to sing never left her.
Yeah.
And as a performer, she understood that, you know.
Yeah.
Because you just got to get out there in front of the audience. You don't care if it's 3 people or 3,000. You got to get up there and sing.
Yeah. Yeah. But she was remarkable that way. She was called Lady Day.
Right.
You talk about that in the book. And there is a real sense of her as royalty.
Yes. Yes.
It's really quite extraordinary.
Right. Well, part of the reason I wanted to write the book was to correct the record. Because you've seen the two movies. You're a movie nut like I am. You've seen Lady Sings the Blues. You've seen United States versus Billie Holiday. Those movies, now I know for sure because I've done the research, you know, are just completely factually wrong, particularly the United States versus Billie Holiday. There's almost not an accurate scene in that movie. All the facts are wrong. And also, I just felt that Billie came off as being, you know, some of the depiction of her in those two films was a bit degrading, you know, beneath the dignity of a proud, successful African-American woman who had recorded, you know, over 300 songs in her career, you know, had recorded The Strange Fruit, which became, you know, an anthem that led into the civil rights movement. And I'm thinking, why are they focusing? And she did have a drug habit in the mid-40s, and it was severe, and it landed her in prison. But as Hazel Scott says, there's a Hazel Scott quote in my book, she says, but after that, while she did use drugs recreationally, she was never really seriously addicted again. And as she would get busted and whatnot through the years, they would run tests on her and whatnot. Sure enough, she didn't have drugs in her system. And so I'm not whitewashing her, because particularly the Annie Ross at the end of her life, they were dabbling in heroin. But I just felt the focus was wrong. And I wanted to try to correct that by pointing out some of the milestones and accomplishments that she was able to achieve in her life.
Yeah. Toward the end of the book, you talk about the obituaries and how really, I think you could say unfair and distorted.
Oh my God, the Time magazine, if you want to call it an obit, was just, it was insulting, you know? And all of them focused on the heroine, like the movies do, the two movies. So I'm hoping there's a bit of a correction. You know, I say I'm on my reclamation tour because I'm trying to reclaim you know, some of her dignity, because that's what she pointed out, how regal she appeared. And she was, particularly on stage. She was a regal presence. And I'm trying to recapture that a little bit.
Yeah. I love the descriptions of her performances, how she just, you know, stood there or seated or whatever it was without really much movement or gesture and just sang. It's a kind of underplaying, I think, that is all the more powerful.
Yeah, there was, I quote a critic at one point, you know, I'm paraphrasing, you know, she would move her head and mountains would crumble because she was so, not even stationary, I guess is the word. And it just drew the audience, the lack of movement tended to draw the audience in. And they got more and more, you know, the songs were intimate in the first place because of her delivery style. People thought that she was singing directly to them. And so that lack of movement, it enhanced that. And so you just felt like you were, I remember when Dan Morgenstern, I interviewed him, the great jazz critic. He says it just she would draw you into the song because of that lack of movement. You just felt like you were a part of the drama, even at the back of the Strand Theater. You know, she had that effect on people.
Yeah, that's amazing, because there are actors who've done that on film, but to do it, you know, on stage,
yes,
so to speak, where your image, your visage isn't projected
right
the way it is with a camera, that's truly extraordinary.
Well, and Madeleine Perrot pointed out to me that, you know, the wonderful jazz singer out, you know, who's very popular right now, who studied Billy, you know, because so many people compare Madeleine to Billy. She said, well, I know why she couldn't move, because it was the way she breathed.
She
didn't sing like a normal singer. She breathed, she controlled her breath like she was a trumpet player. And if you're pushing out air like a trumpet player, you can't be running around the stage. You have to stand still to do it. And I thought, Jesus Christ, that's so interesting that, you know, part of the reason that the image got created with the stationary look that she had with, you know, with a flower in her hair and all that, was just very technical reasons. She had to stand still in order to breathe properly.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So here's this great artist, and certainly her fellow musicians knew she was a great artist. And yet at the same time, she's targeted
repeatedly,
by both the FBI, but in some ways even more by
the
New
FBI.
York City, losing her license and her cabaret license, and then the, you know, armed guards in her hospital room when she's in an oxygen tent.
Right. I point this out in the book repeatedly, that from 1939, when she headlined at Cafe Society and became a national figure, she was well known before then. You know, she'd come up in Harlem. She'd toured with Count Basie and with Artie Shaw. So people knew she had done the Teddy Wilson stuff, you know, the great Teddy Wilson recordings. But Cafe Society, and Billy says this in her book, made her famous. She was famous after that. And so she put a target on her back in 1939 by, she was the first headliner at Cafe Society, the first integrated nightclub in America. And so she had a target on her back from 1939. And then just 3 months after that, she released Strange Fruit, which put an even bigger target on her back. And she lived with that. I remember interviewing Jack Gilford's widow, Madeleine Lee Gilford. And Jack was the host at Cafe Society. And Madeleine said that routinely when he and Billy left at, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, there would be policemen, maybe federal agents, all just standing out surveilling the club. So that's what they dealt with from the very start. And then when Billy developed her heroin problem in the mid 40s, not only did she have a target on her back, but now they had something that they could bring her down with. They could arrest her for narcotics possession. And that's what they did in 1947. Sent her away for almost a year in prison, the same prison where Martha Stewart served. And but then they didn't let up. They arrested her again in the late 40s in San Francisco. They went to trial with that. The jury found that that evidence had been planted on her, and they found her not guilty. The foreman came out afterwards and announced to the press that they believed she had been framed by her then boyfriend and an FBN agent in San Francisco. She was arrested in 56 in Philadelphia on charges based on evidence that it could have easily been planted. They harassed her through the customs service, believe it or not, because she had not filled out some papers when she left the country and came back for a European tour.
That's an astonishing episode.
It was unbelievable. The customs service harassing the woman and threatening to prosecute her.
Yeah.
And then of course the end, which you mentioned, she was arrested on what was her deathbed. She was she was fingerprinted. She was mugshot. They took a mugshot. She was not handcuffed to her bed like they have it depicted in one of the movies. But they did every degrading thing imaginable to her in that hospital room, including having the Manhattan District Attorney insists that she appear before a grand jury. And her lawyer said she's in critical condition. She can't get out of bed. So you know what they did? They took her off the critical condition list.
Yeah.
But obviously she couldn't get out of the bed. How could she appear before a grand jury? And I think that harassment at the end of the life, at the end of her life in that hospital room by the New York City Police Department, I think that contributed to her just finally giving up. I think they broke her will to live.
Yeah. The here she was, you know, jazz singer, not actively involved in social protest as such. She does this song, Strange Fruit, and that seems to mark her.
Yes, for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about a lynching.
Right.
And particularly, because, you know, she did play other cities that where she didn't lose her cabaret license.
No.
But New York City, you would think in some ways, you know, you would think Boston, you know, banned in Boston.
Yeah.
But she wasn't banned in Boston.
No,
she was banned
in her, what became her home city, her home base, New York City. She never got over it. She was angry about that until the day she died. She kept threatening to move to Paris or London for good reason. And they banned her in 1948 when she got out of prison. And so the ban was she couldn't appear in any venue that sold liquor. That was the law. That was the little, you know, trick that they used. So her comeback concert in 1948 was at Carnegie Hall, where apparently they don't sell liquor. They didn't that night.
Yeah.
And she could play the Strand, where they didn't, you know, a huge house where they didn't sell liquor. There was a place down in the Village that she played repeatedly because they didn't sell liquor. But her, you know, she made a living on 52nd Street after Cafe Society, those great clubs on 52nd Street, and she couldn't play them anymore because they sold liquor.
There's, you know, there's a Strange Fruit song, but is there something else about New York that caused this, do you think? Is there, you know, there's something about the administration, the people who ran the show, so to speak, that targeted her?
Well, I, what I say when people ask, because they think the whole, you know, because this was the thesis of United States versus Billie Holiday, that there was some concerted effort to destroy her because she wouldn't stop singing Strange Fruit. And I go, well, you know, this came from the government, so it's not organized.
Yeah,
there was nothing organized about what they were doing. It was systematic because they never stopped. So they were persistent, but it wasn't organized. There was no like group of people sitting around going, well, she won't stop singing that damn song. We're going to take her out. That never happened. Yeah. But it was just a pervasive feel among law enforcement. And it was across the country, too, by the way. But why New York wouldn't relent when, you know, numerous people, celebrities, you know, the public tried to get her off the list so that she could get a cabaret card so she could start performing again. I still don't understand why they did it. And when I went down to try to get research from the New York City Police Department, they told me there weren't any files on her. I never got anything at all from the New York City Police Department. You know what that means, Carl.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
I don't believe those records were lost along the way. She was famous when she died. They knew what files they had. So either they're destroyed or they won't give them out.
Yeah. Yeah. Could very well be destroyed.
That's probably destroyed would be my guess.
There's a, you know, there's some moving and in a way sort of hilarious scenes with Tallulah Bankhead.
Well, you know, in many ways, I think that love affair that they had was like, you know, I think it was like maybe the best one either one of them had. I don't know. You
Could
keep
be.
Rooting for them to like, okay, this is working. Why don't you just, you know, come to grips with it? But the times in which they lived, you know, could you imagine Tallulah coming out and saying, yes, I'm in a lesbian relationship with a famous black woman?
Yeah, she didn't do that, but she did keep the door open.
She did. And you know what's funny? I don't know if you use newspapers.com or not for research. It's
Oh, yes, I do.
My God, it's so good because you can find anything on it that they have, and they have an enormous database. So there was, I ran across that story about the dressing room at the Strand during that run in 40, whatever it was, late 40s. She, Billy, Tallulah would come to the midnight show, and then they would go backstage afterwards, and they would have like a little, you know, makeout session on the sofa. And so, and the whole thing was that Tallulah liked to leave the door open, and so everybody knew what was going on. And later, Billy chided her for it in a letter to her, like, you almost got me fired at the Strand. So we know what happened. And I thought, was it really on the sofa? So I'm researching on newspapers.com. I found the sofa.
Yeah.
I found an article about them in that dressing room, and there they were sitting on the sofa.
Yeah. If someone reads this book and they wonder, well, could this possibly be true? You know, I've run across Tallulah in various ways. Faulkner knew her, and Tallulah's in my Faulkner biography. Mm-hmm. Of course, she was in The Little Foxes, so she's in my Hellman biography. She was so flamboyant, so out there, that it's not difficult to envision that sofa at all.
No, and Billy was happy to go along with it. I'm sure she's having a big old time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then Tallulah calls up J. Edgar Hoover.
Yes, on a three-way call. Can you imagine? Back in the day, before a lot of people did three-way calls, she sets up a three-way call, and she basically says, why are you harassing this woman? And typically, we're not harassing her. I don't know what you're talking about. We don't know anything about Billie Holiday. Give me a break.
Yeah.
I mean, in that scene that I have in the book where she's with the custom agents in that interview, they say they have her FBI file. It's on the record.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Absolutely.
So when I called up the FBI while I was doing research to get their stance today, they said the same thing Hoover did. Oh, we never surveilled her. We don't have a file on her. We don't know. Who are you talking about? Billy who? It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's.
Meanwhile, Barney Josephson, the owner of Cafe Society, I talked to his son. His FBI file was over 2,000 pages.
Wow.
So you're going to tell me Barney Josephson has a 2,000-page FBI file, and Billie Holiday, who's much more famous than he, has nothing? When I asked for the file from the FBI, they sent me 12 pages. About the San Francisco arrest in the late 40s. That's it.
Was it redacted? Did they
crack
it out?
A lot of it was even redacted.
Yeah.
12 pages. So there's this
suppression
of information that's gone on through all levels of government. And like I said, it's not organized, but it's systematic.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So what should I have asked you that I didn't ask you? Anything?
You know, Carl, I end every interview that I'm doing with someone with that question. You're the only other person who's done that.
I just want to make sure that, you know, you get to say what you want to say.
Well, I do want to say, but I've mentioned it earlier, but I want to end with it, that if you're looking for a book to read on Billie Holiday, this is the book I would like for you to read if you want to read what I consider to be the accurate depiction of her life, it's a sympathetic portrait to a woman who became a great artist and an American icon. And so it's not a lot of the stuff that you've seen, particularly in the movies. It's a completely different take on Billie. And in my opinion, it's more compelling to the reader. And that's what I would like people to go away with.
Well, I would second that, and I would say in recommending the book, you know, it's by someone who knows what he's doing.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's a big compliment coming from you, Carl. I appreciate
it. Yeah, I think it's important, to say it. It's not only a great story, it's the way the story is told.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. And credit to my editor, Errol McDonald, who let me write it that way, who didn't try to... In fact, he even suggested I make it more cinematic in the telling of it. And I think that's part of the reason. The feedback I'm getting so far is that people, it's like I'm watching a movie. Well, that was the intention.
Yeah. I hope it will be a movie.
Oh, me too.
We need one.
We need one to correct the other two.
Yeah, we really do. Yeah,
we like the real version of her live, where you view her with dignity and respect for what she was able to accomplish, despite all the problems, the poor childhood, the substance abuse. The real problem in her life is that she was an alcoholic. That's what killed her.
Yeah.
The Gordon's gin is what killed her, not heroin.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Good talking to you, Carl. I appreciate it.
We'll have to do this again. Keep writing books.
Absolutely. And thank you for the kind words on my book. Billy would appreciate it.
Yeah. My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks. I'm going to be posting this, so I'll send you a link.
Okay.
And you can post it wherever you like.
Okay. I'll give it to Kanav. They'll do it on social media and stuff.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.